Good morning. Welcome to Grand Rounds. This morning we have a case presentation and a didactic presentation. First, let me introduce someone who you probably all know, Maz Sohal, who is an internal medicine in his third year residency, and then Dr. Brian Vinnick, who is an endocrinologist practicing here at Boca Regional. He received his medical education from University of Michigan, completed his residency in internal medicine at Vanderbilt, and postdoctoral fellowship in endocrinology at the University of North Carolina Division of Endocrinology. He's board certified in internal medicine, endocrinology, and metabolism. He currently practices at East Coast Medical Associates, endocrinology and metabolism. He's also clinical assistant professor of biomedical science at the Charles E. Smith College of Science at FAU University. He's published numerous papers and presentations. Please welcome our presenters to the podium.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Maz. Obviously, this is Dr. Vinnick. So I'm just going to run through a quick two-minute about this case about hypoglycemia patient, and then I'll let the star of the show take over. So let's go through this. So this is the case. This is a 75-year-old male who came for symptoms of hypoglycemia. He said they started about 18 months ago. This was an outpatient visit. Patient stated that, you know, he's been drinking wine at night, but he would wake up in the middle of the night diaphoretic and confused. On one occasion, EMS found him with a blood glucose of less than 50, which resolved after giving dextrose. And then he's had increased frequencies of these hypoglycemic episodes since then. He's been on a high-protein, low-sugar-carb diet just because he was trying to lose some weight. And majority of his symptoms occurred overnight and occasionally around that 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. period. He started to feel that he needs to eat more frequently, and he started using glucose tablets, about one a day. But he didn't really monitor his blood glucose levels. He didn't want to stick himself. He's a social drinker, denied really any history of liver or pancreatic disease or lesions, and he denied any hypoglycemic medication. This is basically the initial presentation. Really, some weight gain other than aortic valve disease, hypercholesterolemia, and a history of squamous cell cancer. That was really about it. Medications right there, some blood pressure medications. No diabetes and no really other family history. Allergies, just tetracycline. And physical exam, otherwise really benign. Nothing special there. So the workup, the initial labs, this is the workup initially. I put everything together in one slide. This was not all done at one time, but over the course of a few months, these are the labs that we got. Glucose initially when he presented was 53. His CMP otherwise was normal. He did have an elevated proinsulin. Obviously, he had to go and get that at a lab. Normal C-peptide, normal cortisol, normal TSH. Chromogranin A was normal. Negative sulfonylurea screen, IGF-2 is normal, and he also got an MRI with contrast that really didn't show any abdominal lesions or any pancreatic lesions. So the next follow-up visit, this is still at the endocrinologist's office. He refused really to stay in the hospital for his fasting test. He didn't want to do that. He did state that his hypoglycemia continued to be frequent, however, he still managed it with his diet. Hypoglycemic events occurred between meals and early a.m., just like before, and blood glucose continued to be low, and when he did measure it the night before he came in, it was 37. And he's not waking up overnight during this time to eat. So at this time, the patient was referred to Dr. Steinberg to get an EUS, endoscopic ultrasound. And at that time, there's really, when I spoke with Dr. Steinberg about this case, essentially the pancreas looked very homogenous. There was really no specific lesion or specific things he was able to identify. However, he said this one area looked a little bit hyperechoic compared to the rest of the pancreas, and he decided to sample and take a biopsy. During that time, in the room at that point, the cells looked normal, and we were waiting for the formal pathology. Fast forward a little while later, and we got the full pathology. So most of the cells were benign. However, there was a population of atypical cells with pleomorphic nuclei that was suspicious for something. The immunochemical stain showed that it positive for CD56, which you can be positive in neuroendocrine cells, chromogranin and synaptophysin, negative for CD45. Insulin was positive. And the full pathology results showed well-differentiated pancreatic endocrine tumor. And then just follow up, he went to JFK Medical Center, got enucleation of his insulinoma. So, I mean, we already suspected that from what happened. We were just trying to find where the lesion was. And that's pretty much the case. Gives us an idea of what a patient like this may present. And now I'll hand it over to Dr. Vinick to take over. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Nice job. Okay, well, thanks, everyone, for coming out, and thanks for inviting me here again for Grand Rounds. And I do enjoy coming up, and I always learn something when I come up to present, and hopefully I'll get asked some challenging questions. Hypoglycemia can be very challenging. People ask me what I do. I educate people, usually about diabetes, thyroid, osteoporosis, but I get people coming in with weird symptoms, shakes, sweats, flushing, tremor, palpitations, insomnia, and hypoglycemia is in the differential for all of that. Someone comes in, you know, with sweats and headaches and tremors, they have a fear, right? Fairly rare. Insulinoma also fairly rare. Gonna go back here a little towards the staining over here, and once you find the lesion, it's fairly easy in terms of figuring out what's going on. Is this neuroendocrine or not? Unfortunately, Dr. Steinberg did see this little hypoechoic lesion and biopsied it, and they came up with a diagnosis. So usually the star in these cases is the patient. They're rare. We all learn a lot from our patients. That's why we're here. That's why we go through training. And fortunately, this guy's going to have a good outcome if this was an isolated lesion and not diffuse beta cell hypertrophy. But from the sound of it, it was an isolated lesion, and this guy's going to be cured and then live a normal life. It's not unusual that people will not really want to come in and do a 48-hour fast or a 72-hour fast. If you really think that someone's got an insulinoma, you put them in hospital because you get sugars down in the 30s and 20s and they have a seizure. You really need to watch them. This guy was fairly well compensated initially, but he would have declined and he could have died from this. So the objectives, we'll skip to part two. This is really what I want to go over. You have number one in your outline. The differential diagnosis and diagnosis. Is it really hypoglycemia? And that can be difficult to determine. And is it causing the symptoms? Because it may not be. And then we have to be detectives. Again, that's why we're here. We're learning how to get a history, physical, look at medications, look at family history, and find out the most likely cause of the symptoms, how we do the diagnosis, and then looking at treatment. If you guys have any questions as we go along, just put up your hand or yell out, and we can stop and go over it. So what is hypoglycemia? A clinical syndrome characterized by episodes of low blood glucose. That's kind of hard to define. If you look up what a normal glucose is, 60 to 100. Well, is 60 normal for everyone? Probably not. But you can have a glucose tolerance test, and especially thin women can go down to the 40s and have no symptoms. So actually defining it, you need to have a few other things. You need to have symptoms. So true hypoglycemia episodes are typically marked by metabolic encephalopathy, neuroglycopenia, so the brain's not getting enough glucose. So glucose goes to the brain passively. There isn't a glucose transporter, and that's probably a survival bias through evolution so that you don't need to rely on a glucose transporter as you do in fat and muscle to get glucose to the most important organ, the brain. It's not the heart for you guys out there who are cardiologists. So autonomic manifestations alone do not indicate a hypoglycemic disorder. So if you have hyperadrenergic symptoms, it could be something else. It could be caffeine, could be a pheo, but the tremor and the sweats aren't necessarily from hypoglycemia. So you really need Whipple's triad. neurogenic and neuroglycopenic symptoms, and a measured low plasma glucose concentration, whatever that definition might be, and then relief by raising the plasma glucose. So if someone's got symptoms and they're flushing, sweating, shaking, tremor, headache, and you give them glucose and you measure their sugar and it's good and they still have symptoms, then the hypoglycemia isn't causing it, and maybe it's not true hypoglycemia. So you really need this to confirm the presence of clinical hypoglycemia. And if you don't have that, you really don't need to undergo this big workup. So the classification, there are a few different ways to do it, insulin-mediated or non-insulin-mediated. So anything that is originating in the pancreas, endogenous hyperinsulinemia, injected insulin, insulin secretagogues, insulinotropic agents, the GLP-1, the DPP-4s, sulfonylureas, glinenides, they're all going to raise insulin, and that's insulin-mediated. What's non-insulin-mediated? Well, it could be insulin antibodies, IGF-2, sarcomas, etc., possibly Addison's with low cortisol as your counter-regulatory hormone. So it's important to determine an insulin level when you have hypoglycemia. And we'll go through that algorithm. Fasting or postprandial. Now, in this case, the hypoglycemia was nocturnal and fasting. So that's one of the tip-offs in your mind that that could be an insulinoma. They typically wake up hypoglycemic because they haven't had any calories in. Factitious hypoglycemia, when people cause hypoglycemia, Munchausen's or whatever category you want to put it under, occurs without regard to meals. So if people are injecting insulin or taking hypoglycemic agents, that's going to trigger the hypoglycemia, and there's no real pattern usually. Finding out if people are doing that, that's a whole other topic. It's usually in healthcare providers, people who have access to insulin and those drugs, of course. So hypoglycemia in apparently healthy patients. So single episodes, accidental drug ingestion, ethanol, quinine, salicylates, sulfonylureas, of course, the diabetic drugs. Leviquin in the PI, it states that with the first IV dose of Leviquin, you can get hypoglycemia. The flip side of that, when we used to have Tequin, would cause sugars to go up into the 500s, 800s, no history of diabetes, unexplained eventually. Taken off the market. So the fluoroquinolones can certainly have effects on high or low sugars. So I had a patient at Vanderbilt in my training, seen in the ER, and she had severe hypoglycemia, and she wasn't diabetic, and no diabetic drugs. Her husband wasn't diabetic, and she had glaucoma, and she was meant to get acetazolamide for glaucoma, and the pharmacist got the bottle next to it that was acetohexamide. So that's a strong diabetic drug that we used to use, hypoglycemic agent. And so a little bit of detective work when they bring in their pills might lead you to a diagnosis of why they got hypoglycemic. So in this apparently healthy patient, multiple episodes of excessive insulin production, insulinoma, or maybe a post-gastric bypass syndrome that we'll get to, factitious use of insulin or secretagogue, and then side effects of treatment for diabetes. So this clearly is number one, right? And that's the limiting factor in treating our patients with tight control. And we found out from the ACCORD trial, when you try to get hemoglobin A1C down to 6 or below, you had sudden cardiac death. And so that's the limiting factor in treating our diabetics. So hypoglycemia in ill patients. If you have advanced liver disease, the liver, of course, is an endocrine gland. Everything's an endocrine gland, including bone, as you guys know, and the heart. So the liver with gluconeogenesis, glycogenolysis, raising your sugar when the sugar's low, so you got to have a good liver to prevent hypoglycemia. Glucagon works there, and catecholamines work there. Chronic renal failure, especially if you have diabetic drugs, you have decreased clearance, congestive heart failure, low output, sepsis, and then hospitalized patients are at risk for iatrogenic hypoglycemia, and you can have mistakes or overuse of diabetic drugs. So artifactual hypoglycemia, low glucose, an artifact from consumption of glucose in blood collection tube by large numbers of nucleated red cells or leukocytes in patients with hemolysis or leukemia. So that's going to be an in vitro error. An in vivo error, I got called for someone who was in the ICU here about 16 years ago. It was a dialysis patient who had staph sepsis. She was on the vent, she was very ill, and they were doing finger stick glucoses because she was diabetic, They were not giving her insulin, and they were getting 15s, 20s, 30s, things that almost didn't register with a finger stick. And she was so clamped down and septic that the blood wasn't actually getting to her fingertips, so they were getting artificially low readings. And we actually did some earlobe finger sticks on her, and we got decent readings. And then they were drawing sugars from the arterial line, and that's how we got real readings. So being a detective, you can think about all of these things in your workup. Then when you get someone who's really got hypoglycemia, you start doing your workup. Measure the blood glucose when possible. The EMTs will usually do a finger stick. Getting the history, description of symptoms, the timing's really important. The circumstances, medication history, again, is extremely important. This guy was on a statin. He was on an ARB. He was on a thiazide. Thiazides typically cause insulin resistance and raise sugar. It wasn't on anything that might cause hypoglycemia, some of those drugs we went over. And then have them bring in the pill bottle so you can actually see what's there, like my lady in the ER. Signs and symptoms. So we have diaphoresis and pallor. You may have some tachycardia and elevation of blood pressure. And then neuroglycopenic manifestations are often observable. So someone throw out a number. What's the lowest sugar anyone's seen if someone is sitting in the office talking to you? Anyone seen under 50? Show of hands. Under 40. Under 30. So I have some patients who are really, really compliant on pumps, multiple shots, and they like to keep the A1Cs low. And when they get below 6, I tell them, you're too low, you're going to have a seizure. So this one very bright gentleman came in and he's talking to me, and the nurse comes running in, his finger sticks 28, and he was just starting to have neuroglycopenic symptoms. So you get acclimatized to low sugar, and you have to be really careful. And in people who have hypoglycemic unawareness with autonomic dysfunction, they don't get the tremor, the sweats. The first thing they know is they're out cold. So using glucose sensors for those people can be very helpful. You can occasionally get transient focal neurologic deficits. So it may appear that someone's had a stroke and you go back to having euglycemia and the focal deficit can occur. And that can happen when I did my DKA talk. The same thing, you can have focal deficits that will resolve related to metabolic derangements. So neurogenic symptoms, tremor, palpitations, anxiety, arousal, catecholamine mediated, these are the adrenergic. And then sweating, hunger, paresthesias, these are acetylcholine mediated and cholinergic. The neuroglycopenic, again, cognitive impairment, behavioral changes. You know, people will say, my husband's got really cranky, headachy, irritable, and that can be from the neuroglycopenia, psychomotor abnormalities, having trouble with coordination, and then when it gets worse, seizure and coma. So this is Mayo Clinic data in a study of patients with insulinomas. 85% had various combinations of these symptoms, sometimes blurred vision, 80% confusion or abnormal behavior, 12% with generalized seizures. So it's a pretty high number having seizures. So that's definitely on your differential. And Dr. Katzen was telling me of a patient he got called on who had a sugar of 70 with a seizure, may have had, you know, hypoglycemia before the EMTs got there, and then we're talking about counter-regulatory hormones. We'll discuss a little later on. Different patients may have differing symptoms, but in any one patient, usually they have the same symptoms with each episode. So it's kind of unique to that patient. Patients who have only autonomic symptoms without neuroglycopenic are unlikely to have hypoglycemia. And then we're talking about other things, stimulants, pheos, et cetera, carcinoid, other things that might cause flushing that you might confuse with the pallor of hypoglycemia. And many patients have only neuroglycopenic, which occurred at a threshold of about 50. So once the sugar gets below 50, you start getting a little goofy, lose your train of thought, get a headache, have trouble concentrating, balancing the checkbook, etc. That's where these counter-regulatory hormones kick in. About a glucose of 55. So just before you start getting a little goofy, everything else kicks in to try and raise sugar. Well, insulin is the primary hormone that blunts postprandial hyperglycemia, and so it's counterbalanced by several factors, but these hormones are secreted in response to hypoglycemia, and they raise glucose quickly and then over the long term. So there are different ones that will work in the short term and the long term. Often you'll get a rebound hyperglycemia. Sometimes we talk about Somogyi effect. When someone's hypoglycemic overnight, they rebound and they're high in the morning. And if you just look at the morning sugar and they're on insulin, you may want to increase the insulin, but that may make them more hypoglycemic. And again, monitoring the sugar overnight with a sensor would tell you which way you need to go, high or low on the insulin. So again, getting back to insulin, it causes this low sugar, so what you want to do, you want to shut it off. So that's the first defense for hypoglycemia, is turn off insulin once the sugar gets down to 80 or 85. The next thing that happens is the pancreas makes glucagon, and that's the weight, the balance that you have in the pancreas in terms of insulin and glucagon. It acts only on the liver, so you need a functioning liver. Again, we talked about liver disease and hypoglycemia. Increasing glucose production by stimulating glycogenolysis and gluconeogenesis in the liver from alanine and from other amino acids and glycerol. So you need to have some stores in the liver to be able to do this. In someone who's malnourished, that might not happen. So again, the glycemic threshold is 65 to 70. You need to have a normal liver for that to work. Third defense is epinephrine. So this is where you get the shakes and the sweats. Beta 2 adrenergic receptors, similar hepatic effects as glucagon, so it also can work through the liver. And then it brings in these gluconeogenic substrates from the periphery, and via alpha 2 receptors inhibits insulin secretion, so it's a true counter-regulatory hormone at different levels, both the liver, mobilization of these factors, and then inhibiting insulin secretion. So people say to you, well, can stress raise my blood sugar? And I say, well, does it raise your blood pressure? Yes. Well, it's going to raise your blood sugar too. So people who have psychosocial stressors, they have high cortisol, they have high catecholamines, and they tend to be more insulin resistant. And so that's something that you can think about addressing when your diabetics are hyperglycemic. So again, the glycemic threshold is similar with that, with catecholamines. Cortisol and growth hormone work slowly over time. So if someone comes in acutely hypoglycemic, should you give them a bolus of a glucocorticoid? It's not going to work for a while. Rather give them dextrose and then whatever else you need to do, and maybe measure a cortisol if you think they have coexisting adrenal insufficiency. Growth hormone, the same, secreted in the early hours of the morning. Testosterone probably causes a little bit of insulin resistance, but certainly it's not a counter-regulatory hormone like these. So the epinephrine will give you your autonomic symptoms of hypoglycemia. And then one little caveat, the rate of decrease of blood glucose doesn't always influence the occurrence of symptoms. So we always say, is it the absolute sugar or is it how quickly the sugar went down? And we tend to think that if someone normally runs 300 and you bring them down to 80 fairly quickly, they'll have hypoglycemic symptoms. A lot of your diabetics tell you, I don't feel good if my sugar's below 110. And we say, well, that's because you run 300 to 400 all the time. And maybe you need to get used to glycemia. It's probably true to an extent, but in terms of true hypoglycemic symptoms, that doesn't seem to be the case. So here are your counter-regulatory hormones. This is your glucose in millimoles, and this is milligrams per deciliter that we're more used to here. Just multiply that by 18 to get here. And these are the thresholds for secretion. So you can see around 55 or so is where you're going to have cortisol, growth hormone, and epinephrine and glucagon a little earlier, around 65 to catch it early, and then below 50 you start getting your symptoms. So hypoglycemic unawareness, when do people not know that their sugar is going to be low? Glucagon and epi are the two major defense hormones against prolonged hypoglycemia. Glucagon comes from the pancreas, and the response to hypoglycemia diminishes after a few years of type 1 diabetes. So not only are they very sensitive to insulin, but then they lose their glucagon working through the liver to raise sugar, and they can rarely get severely hypoglycemic without a good rebound. Epinephrine may save them temporarily, also working through the liver as we discussed, but after about 10 years of type 1 diabetes, you can lose the epinephrine response to hypoglycemia. So then these people are rarely brittle and rarely frail, and a good hemoglobin A1C for those patients could be 9. You know, it really depends on the situation. So you can lose the hypoglycemic awareness with autonomic diabetic neuropathy. Usually you will not have autonomic neuropathy if there isn't evidence of peripheral neuropathy. So doing a good exam on the lower extremities and determining if that's really the case, they may have autonomic neuropathy if they have peripheral. So again, hypoglycemia is the limiting step in treating our diabetic patients intensively. So this brings us to our 72-hour fast. Once you have an evaluation, you determine the patient's hypoglycemic, you bring them into the hospital and you do this evaluation. Whipple's triad, the three things that you need, the low sugar, the symptoms, and the resolution of symptoms when you restore euglycemia. And you're trying to figure out why they're hypoglycemic. So you're looking at beta cell peptides and sulfonylurea levels. On the back or at the last page of the handout, you have the summary slide on the whole workup, and we'll go over that, at least parts of it, toward the end. So the beta cell peptides, we're looking at C-peptide, which is co-secreted with insulin, obviously insulin, and then proinsulin can also be helpful when you have insulinomas, so you typically measure those three. We look at sulfonylurea and meglitinides, which you can do as part of a drug screen, a blood drug screen when people come in hypoglycemic, and rule this in or out as a cause. Stop the fast when the sugar gets down below 55. If the sugar is not low and you get insulin levels and they're high, it really doesn't tell you anything. Most of our type 2 diabetics early on are going to have hyperinsulinemia, and you can get, I've seen insulin levels of, you know, over 150 when the sugar is 200. You know, that's not an insulinoma. So below 55, the beta cell polypeptides should be suppressed, and then you stop the fast, they become hypoglycemic, and you look for signs of neuroglycopenia. So make sure if you think someone's got an insulinoma that you got some D50 standing by and maybe a D10 drip, you might need that, because if they go out fast on you, you need to resuscitate them. So D50 is kind of our crash cart of hypoglycemia. So plasma insulin, and I have a slide looking at insulin, C-peptide, beta-hydroxybutyrate compared to glucose a little later on. 3 microunits per ml by ICMA when the glucose is below 55 indicates an excess of insulin and is consistent with insulinoma. But as I mentioned earlier, a lot of people will have sugars below 50 and be asymptomatic. So you really need symptoms on this test before you get these levels. Occasionally, people with insulinoma won't go that low. This might be early on in the disease, so they have a small tumor burden. Again, these lesions can be very, very tiny. And as they get a little bit bigger, you know, the sugar will then drop later on. But they may not drop low. So you have to look at the insulin, C-peptide, proinsulin, and so on. And then if you have a hemolyzed blood sample, of course, the insulin, being a peptide, may get hydrolyzed and disappear. You may have a false reading, and so make sure that you handle the samples well. So you can't have your phlebotomist go around the whole unit, you know, drawing blood samples. If they're drawing peptides like insulin, ACTH, et cetera, C-peptide, these samples have to be processed quite rapidly, frozen, if you're going to send them out. So here's a prolonged fast, and in normal people, you'll see here, the glucose is typically going to be 50 and above, and the insulin level here on the x-axis is relatively low. This is insulin down here, microunits per ml. And then in insulinoma, obviously the sugar's low, starting at around 54 here on this graph, and then higher insulin levels. So it's these people who have the insulinomas. Looking at C-peptide, it's going to be similar. You have your normals up here and your insulinomas over here. Where's the cutoff? It's at 0.2. So if all you have is a C-peptide and a low blood sugar, you'll say, well, if the C-peptide is, you know, assuming they're not on insulin and type 1s, less than 0.2 would be normal. And then if you get it above 0.2 with a low sugar, that's probably an insulinoma. Proinsulin is going to be similar. The criteria would be 5. As your cutoff, you can see if you go back to the C-peptide, there's less overlap. And with the proinsulin, there's a little more overlap here. But there, the cutoff would be 5. But the more data you can get, the better to try and put this whole thing together. Beta-hydroxybutyrate. So we have an assay that we're doing now that for people who come in with presumed DKA, so it's fairly easy to do. And how does this work? Well, you only need a little bit of insulin to prevent ketosis. You need a lot of fluid to get rid of ketones in DKA. So little insulin's all you need initially. And so when you have insulinoma patients, the beta-hydroxybutyrate concentrations are going to be lower because you have a lot of insulin on board. So basically, your insulinoma patients, you're going to have over here with a low glucose, and then at the end of the fast, you measure the beta-hydroxy. So they're going to have levels of 2.7 millimoles or less in the insulinoma patients. Glucagon stimulation. So insulin is going to cause a lot of glucose to be deposited in fat, in muscle, and the liver is going to be a good store for your gluconeogenesis and glycogenolysis. And if you have a lot of insulin, that's going to be higher. So if you give glucagon to an insulinoma patient, they'll have a more vigorous rise in the glucose response. And if it goes up by 25 milligrams per deciliter or more, that's consistent with insulinoma. If they don't, it's probably not an insulinoma. I've never done this test. And if your results are equivocal, then you can maybe think about doing glucagon stimulation. Insulin secretagogues, we've mentioned this, sulfonylureas, meglitinides. We have a lot of different agents now, as I mentioned, the GLP-1, indirectly the DPP-4s. And the beta cell peptides are identical to those of insulinoma because they're insulinotropic, so you have to keep that in mind. So you always measure these in your patients with hypoglycemia. Insulin antibodies. So when we had beef pork insulin, when I was doing my fellowship, we still had these. When I came over here, they were being phased out. That was 21 years ago. And so we had a lot of antibodies. Non-diabetics, you know, people in this room probably have low levels of insulin antibodies. They're not clinically significant. But back here, we would have insulin antibodies causing insulin resistance because the insulin was bound and couldn't bind to a receptor. But they can also constitutively activate the receptor in terms of binding, and you can have hypoglycemia. So the current human analogs cause very little antibody production. If you look at the PIs, there are data on insulin antibodies with all the analogs that are coming out. And high tide is maybe diagnostic of insulin autoimmune hypoglycemia. Oral glucose tolerance test, don't use that as part of an evaluation for hypoglycemia because a lot of people will have reactive hypoglycemia. Again, thin people who are malnourished are going to have low sugars. They have low liver stores of where glucagon and epinephrine can raise sugar. And at least 10% of healthy people will have values of less than 50 during the test. So just don't use the GTT for hypoglycemia. It's really only for hyperglycemia. What's a better test? Mixed meal test. So your 72-hour fast or your mixed meal test. So what's the difference? For patients with neuroglycopenic symptoms, within 5 hours after eating, you do the mixed meal test. What is a mixed meal? It's what people normally eat. So you can get a can of Ensure, some Boost, some Sustacal. That's fine as a mixed meal test. It's not your 75-gram dextrose glucose tolerance test. So if people have postprandial hyperglycemia, nasidioblastosis, or beta cell hypertrophy, post-gastric bypass syndrome, this is what you want to do. What do you measure? You measure the same things. You measure the pancreatic peptides related to insulin, and you'll also do a sulfonylurea screen and so on and so forth, insulin antibodies, cortisol level, if you think that's appropriate. So again, the tests are positive if you have the symptoms and a measured low sugar, and it doesn't give you a diagnosis. It just confirms that they actually truly have hypoglycemia, and then you need to measure your levels to try and figure out what's going on and do your imaging. Insulinoma, about 3 to 10 cases per million people per year. It's about 55% of neuroendocrine tumors. I've only seen 3 cases. I didn't see, you know, this person. The one case was metastatic insulinoma, pretty rare. Maybe 8% of cases are metastatic, and it's someone that we treated medically, and then she went on to have chemotherapy. But that's usually not with a good outcome. I saw a young woman who had given birth, and she was in the hospital here, and Dr. Johnson had called me because of hypoglycemia. Immediately assume it's a diabetic who's on too much insulin. Go see this young, healthy-looking woman, not diabetic. and you think about factitious things like that. But I wrote the protocol for drawing all the labs, and they called me 10 o'clock at night. We didn't need to go 72 hours, so sugar was 36. And we ended up having her go down to Miami, and they found the tumor and cured her, so that was a really good outcome. The other one was a case of a woman who was in her 80s, and she had symptoms. I said, you have an insulinoma, we'll cure you with surgery. She didn't want that. She went about 10 years. This started when she was in her mid-70s. And treated her with diazoxide. She did really well. It's a fairly expensive agent, but she could afford it. And then eventually she had syncope, and her symptoms got worse, and she had surgery, and she was cured. She had an isolated lesion. So only three cases in 21 years of practicing, not that common. And all three had a different clinical spectrum. So the age range, 8 to 82, this can really occur at any age. 8% of these, multiple endocrine neoplasia type 1. I have one patient right now with MEN1. 6% malignant, so as I said, somewhere in the 6 to 8 range malignant and can metastasize. They've been found in pregnant patients, people with type 1 diabetes, and they actually had a patient, or type 2, a patient with type 1 diabetes who also had an insulinoma, so you can't rule it out completely. So if that C-peptide goes from zero to something measurable, you've got to wonder what's happening in that type 1 patient. Insulinoma, hypoglycemia caused by excessive insulin secretion, pancreatic islet cell tumor secreting insulin from the beta cells, and then you need to exclude hypoglycemia from exogenous sources, as I mentioned. So this is the part where I start keeping track of time so I don't keep you guys too long. So how do you localize? It can be very difficult. Don't do imaging studies for any endocrine tumor type disorder until you've made a biochemical diagnosis, because we have all of these things that we find. Incidentalomas, 8% pituitary microadenomas, 8% adrenal, typically benign adenomas. In the pancreas, when you see things, they're not always malignant, but you have to be more suspicious. But you really want the biochemical diagnosis before you start messing around with the pancreas. So transabdominal ultrasound, probably 50% chance of finding a lesion. High-resolution CT, about 80%. The endoscopic ultrasound's about 77%. So this patient had that done initially, and they didn't find it. Sometimes, like my young lady, in retrospect, after surgery, they said, oh, now we look at the film, having taken out the lesion, they could find the lesion on CT, but they really didn't know it was there until they went in. So intraoperative ultrasound with palpation of the pancreas by an experienced surgeon is the best way to find these lesions. So you're actually palpating the pancreas. And apparently, Maz told me that they went in and they palpated this guy's pancreas and could feel the lesion. It was under a centimeter, I believe, and they took it out or enucleated. 98% success rate in the identification of the insulinoma, and obviously you're going to have a good surgical outcome. So after localization, you go to surgery. So surgical removal, of course, is the best way to cure these patients. Surgery is wonderful for many endocrine disorders such as Kahn syndrome, aldosteronoma. You take it out, you're cured. Surgical removal of the insulinoma is what you need. Medical therapy, including diazoxide, suppressing insulin secretion. I did have someone where I couldn't get diazoxide initially, and I used high-dose hydrochlorothiazide, and that did help keep the sugar up. And when I say up, I mean in the 60 to 70 range until we got the diazoxide. Side effects of the medication, edema and hirsutism, and lack of availability is an issue and cost, so you have to call up the pharmacy and say you need this drug right away. Other meds have been used, somatostatin or octreotide and analogs, and you can actually do octreotide scanning, gallium scanning, PET CT that can increase your sensitivity of the scan by about 8 to 10% over regular CT, and you can localize and possibly treat with somatostatin. So medical therapy is used in patients who are not acceptable because of surgical risks, age, comorbidities, CHF, etc. But if you can operate, operate, because it can be curative. So then from this insulinoma where you have a discrete lesion, what happens if you have non-discrete? Non-insulinoma, pancreatogenous hypoglycemia syndrome, NIPHS. So it's the syndrome that was reported in 1999 again. I came here in 96, so this is reported shortly after that. And it's typically in patients who are adult, who don't have an insulinoma, but they do have the hypoglycemic syndrome, and it's from pancreatic postprandial insulin hypersecretion. So this might seem like an insulinoma on initial presentation, but this isn't overnight, and this isn't fasting hypoglycemia, it's postprandial. Typically, we see people with these symptoms, and we think that they're pre-diabetic, they've lost first phase insulin secretion, they have a prolonged second phase insulin secretion, they have reactive hypoglycemia. Those people typically don't pass out. These people do pass out, so that raises your clinical suspicion. And then you do a mixed meal tolerance test. So here was the age range in the Mayo series. All have severe neuroglycopenic symptoms, loss of consciousness and or seizures, usually males, and about one-fifth as frequently as insulinoma in the Mayo studies that they did. So again, symptoms are postprandial. You have low glucose, high insulin levels. 72-hour fasts are normal. So if you fast these people, if you don't stimulate gut hormones, which is the theory for this, then you don't get hypoglycemia. And patients with insulinoma, typically the 72 hours are positive. Radiologic studies are going to be negative. So this would be similar to doing a parathyroid nuclear study. When you have hyperplasia, you don't see a focal lesion because everything's hot. It would be the same over here. You don't see a focal lesion. So because you have diffuse beta cell hyperplasia, no discrete tumor, you need to do a partial pancreatectomy. So you need to talk to the patient, talk to the surgeon. You might do a distal pancreatectomy. You need to tell the patient that you haven't cured them because this could come back, and they need to be cognitive of symptoms, which may recur after several years. And then you may treat them medically depending on their age, or you may need to reoperate. Factitious. We talked about this earlier, self-induced, more common in women, usually with healthcare workers, as I mentioned, with access to medications. And in diabetics, they suggest it might be more common than recognized since diagnosis is difficult. We know that with diabetes, there's some psychosocial issues. There's a high prevalence of depression, and people may be attention-seeking by causing hypoglycemia and getting attention that way. So it's something that needs to be considered in people with diabetes. Administering insulin, insulin secretagogues will lead to this. Sometimes a parent may administer the insulin to a child. You know, Munchausen's by proxy, causing the hypoglycemia for whatever reasons. It has been used to attempt suicide or homicide, as you know from a famous case. And then mistaken prescription for hypoglycemic drugs, which I mentioned earlier. So you should think about it in every patient undergoing evaluation for hypoglycemia. It is more common than insulinoma, so you really need to consider it, especially when they have no patin. And healthcare providers who have access to these agents, look at all the medications, identify them, look at every single pill, and put it under the pill identifier if you need to. So again, you measure C-peptide, insulin, sulfonylurea, glutenide levels when you have hypoglycemia. It's really the same workup as you do for insulinoma. So your screen comes up positive, and then you have a diagnosis. If it's insulin, you're going to have high insulin, and you'll suppress C-peptide. In very insulin-resistant patients with high endogenous insulin levels, the C-peptide may not be suppressed down, you know, below that 0.2 level. And then they mention, you know, type 1 diabetics measuring the C-peptide. If it's usually zero, but they start having a lot of hypoglycemia, and then the C-peptide is measurable, they may have an insulinoma. I have not seen that. Again, I have had 3 cases in 21 years of insulinoma, so I have certainly not seen all the variations. Insulin autoimmune, very rare. This happens more in people of Japanese or Korean ethnicity, can occur at any age. And it has no gender predilection, and I mentioned the mechanism. Many patients may have ongoing autoimmune disorder, so you know they may have Hashimoto's, they may have lupus, Sjogren's, so on. And so you know one autoimmune disorder is usually more prevalent when you have another, and it's the same with this. maybe I caused the problem. Maybe I gave them an antithyroid medication, so PTU or methimazole, they can stimulate various conditions such as autoimmune disorders, and this syndrome could be triggered by that as well. So taking a good history is important. And again, you're going to use antithyroid medication in someone probably with Graves' disease, so they already have autoimmune disease. And it's typically, there's no history of insulin exposure in these people. So you can have antibodies to the insulin or the receptor. So this is analogous to Graves' disease, where you have the receptor being stimulated by an antibody. No one knows why, like most autoimmune disease. My patients say, why did I get this? I say, I don't know. Genetic predisposition, some environmental trigger, maybe these drugs, as I mentioned. So postprandial hypoglycemia resulting in neuroglycopenia. And the insulin levels are really high because you have these interfering antibodies. So you get these up in the 1,000 range. And again, very low titers of the antibodies can be seen in normal people. Treatment is supportive, including frequent small meals. And then once again, because you don't have a focal lesion, you may need to do partial pancreatectomy. Medications really don't help. Postgastric bypass hypoglycemia, and you'll see a similar pattern here. People who've had a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, this somehow interferes with the with the peptides in the intestine, GLP-1, GIP, so on, possibly some paracrine actions of some of these peptides. More common in women, occurs several times more frequently than insulinoma, and they have increased secretion of these hormones, possibly GLP-1, causing hypoglycemia. GLP-1 could cause islet cell hypertrophy. Now that we have these agents, when we get 30 years out with them, we might see more prolonged hypoglycemia. We really have to wait and see what happens in the long term with these agents. This guy, in his history, despite being on this diet, the case presentation, he did report weight gain. And typically, when you have a lot of hypoglycemia, you're going to gain weight because you have to eat to prevent, you know, the neuroglycopenic symptoms. And people will gain weight even if they don't want to because they just have to keep up with the high insulin levels. So you're chasing your insulin with calories rather than the normal physiology where it's the other way around. So they'll have postprandial hypoglycemia, so this is similar to the antibodies, the NIPHS, as opposed to insulinoma where it's fasting. So again, management may include partial pancreatectomy. So you see a common theme here. So here's this busy summary slide. The top line is normal. So no symptoms. You'll see a common theme for most of these that are insulin mediated, and they're all going to have high insulin levels. It's only when you get down to the IGF, which is usually IGF-2, that you have low insulin or non-insulin or IGF mediated, where you're going to have low insulin levels. The C-peptides, you can see all pretty much parallel the insulin levels. Proinsulin's going to also parallel the C-peptide and insulin. So if you kind of lump those together, it's not quite that busy. We mentioned the beta-hydroxybutyrate, looking at insulinoma and not. The glucagon, where you have insulin going up with high insulin levels by over 25 milligrams per deciliter when you give glucagon, and it won't if you don't have hyperinsulinemia. And then you're circulating a hypoglycemic agent, that's an easy one. And then antibodies to insulin, that's an easy one. These are the red herrings in there, and then your diagnostic interpretation. So what happens with this IGF-2? It's usually mesenchymal tumors, fibromas, fibrosarcomas, hepatomas, and you know the insulin-like growth factors. They are called insulin-like growth factors because there's a lot of homology with the insulin receptor and the IGF receptors. So insulin can bind to one and vice versa. They're kind of promiscuous. So these growth factors at very high levels start stimulating the insulin receptor, and you get hypoglycemia in that way. And that's why you can measure IGF-2 if you have a suspicion for that. That needs to be sent out to a special lab, of course. So this is basically your algorithm, and these are the things that you're measuring. Again, I have never done this, but these ones are fairly easy to measure. And then you look down through your algorithm and figure out where you are and make your diagnosis. So in summary, hypoglycemia is the syndrome characterized by episodes of blood glucose. You really want to have Whipple's triad before you start chasing down your detective work and finding out where the lesion is. Symptoms can be neuroglycopenic or autonomic. If you have autonomic alone, then it's probably not mediated by hypoglycemia, and you need to look elsewhere. Counter-regulatory hormones defending against hypoglycemia, glucagon, which is quick, epinephrine, which is fairly quick, cortisol and growth hormone kick in later on to achieve euglycemia hours later, epi and glucagon quickly working through hepatic glucose output. Diabetics lose the glucagon production over time, and then they use epinephrine. And then in type 1 diabetics, they can lose that. And then you have your really brittle patient who's going to tend to get hypoglycemic and not recover, have a seizure in the middle of the night, possibly have a coma. So we need to be cognizant of that when we're looking at glycemic targets and treatment of diabetics. So then looking at non-diabetic hypoglycemia, we have insulinoma, we have factitious, medication errors, liver, renal disease, congestive heart failure, sepsis, and then non-insulinoma, pancreatogenous hypoglycemia. When we're looking at insulinoma, we need to look at elevated insulin and C-peptide levels. If you have high insulin, low C-peptide, then it's probably administration of insulin or possibly other causes. You need to have a low glucose to interpret those. If the glucose isn't under 55, you really can't interpret these levels. So if it's not insulinoma, the other ones all typically cause postprandial hypoglycemia. The 72-hour fast is negative, and you need to do a mixed meal tolerance and give them a can of Ensure, you know. Don't get them the diabetic Glucerna. You want to give them a good glucose load. So, you know, get something that's going to mimic a meal. You can't just have them, you know, you ask them, well, what's your favorite meal? You know, and if it's, you know, waffles and syrup, and, you know, have them come in, have some waffles and syrup, and then, you know, every hour you're going to measure these hormones and try and figure out what's causing the hypoglycemia. So, again, thanks for having me here, and thank you, Maz, for the presentation and the case. We don't see these very often, but when we do see them, it really raises our eyebrows because these people are the stars of the show. We learn a lot from them, and when you can make a diagnosis and cure someone like this, that's really why we all are here. So welcome any questions. If you guys have to run and want to call me about any cases, workups, anything, we're just across the street, so please do that.